This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
This is Master Hongzhu's Guidepost for the Hall of Pure Bliss, Part 2. One beam of light's gleam permeates the vastness. The gleam permeates through all directions, from the beginning, not covered or concealed. Catching the opportunity to emerge amid transformations, it flourishes. Following appropriately amid transformations, the pure bliss is unchanged. The sky encompasses it, the ocean seals it, every moment without deficiency. In the achievement without deficiency, inside and outside are interfused. All dharmas transcend their limits. All gates are wide open. Through the open gates are the byways of playful wandering. Dropping off senses and sense objects is like the flowers of our gazing and listening falling away. Gazing and listening are only distant conditions of thousands of hands and eyes. The others die from being too busy, but I maintain continuity. In the wonder of continuity are no traces of subtle identifications. Within purity is bliss, within silence is illumination. The house of silent illumination is the hall of pure bliss. Dwelling in peace and forgetting hardship, let go of adornments and become genuine. The motto for becoming genuine, nothing is gained by speaking. The goodness of Vimalakirti enters the gate of non-duality. So the other day I introduced this and we worked through the first half or so of this poem. And I mentioned a little bit about Hongzhu. Hojin Sensei spoke a little bit about him yesterday as well. So the form of Zazen that he taught and was known for teaching is called silent illumination. And he was within the Zaodong or Soto lineage, which is our lineage. And so he was teaching at a time when also the Linji school was very much present and powerful. And he had a contemporary named Da Wei, whose writings or teachings are collected. Some of his teachings are collected in a edition that I think is out of print called Swampland Flowers. And historically, there was much made of this supposed kind of mutual dislike and disagreement and criticism of Da Wei and Hongzhu. Da Wei criticizing, not actually Hongzhu, but criticizing silent illumination as a practice in the claim that it led to excessive quietism and no insight, no realization. Koan Zen was and has been throughout the ages criticized for leading to excessive intellection, excessive conceptualization, and very little concentration or samadhi. And so a lot was made of this conflict between them. In fact, they were friends. And as I said the other day, when Hongzhu was dying, one of the last things he did was he wrote a letter to Da Wei asking him to take over and just take care of the monastery that Hongzhu was the abbot of. Da Wei's teacher was Yan Wu, who was the compiler of the Blue Cliff Record. Sui Do collected the 100 koans and verses wrote those verses. But Yan Wu collected them all together and put them and then wrote commentaries and footnotes and really fleshed it out as this very significant piece of religious literature and training. And so Hongzhi studied with, also studied with Yanwu. And so he would have clearly had a lot of exposure to koans and I would presume koan study and training. And then he went on to compile his own list of koans, which are collected in the Book of Serenity. And both of those are, of course, parts of our own training here, because they, the Book of Serenity is traditionally associated with the Soto school and the Book of Record with the Rinzai school, a Linji school, but in our lineage, because my Zumi Roshi studied with and was empowered by both Rinzai and Soto teachers, he taught and had his students, as, for example, Dada Roshi, do both of these collections, and that's what we do as well, have continued to do. But more important than this disagreement that they supposedly had was the tension between, in a sense, these two forms of Zazen, and which are significant within our own tradition, the Zen tradition, but really are part of all Buddhist practice. So Buddhist meditation, you know, meditation means so many things these days. I mean, what does it mean, actually? You can ask different people and you'll get very different answers, and including answers both inside and outside of any kind of religious tradition in which meditation has been part of that tradition that has been passed down. In Buddhism, meditation means some very particular things, and two essential things that it has, if it is Buddhist meditation, are these two elements: calming or samadhi and insight, realization, wisdom. And that various forms of meditative practice are sometimes specifically sort of geared or taken up to develop one or the other. So there are meditation practices that are more sort of in the realm of developing concentration and samadhi, and others that are more sort of inclined towards bringing forth wisdom and insight. But in a sense, in essence, I think, every form of meditation needs to have both of these elements happening, which means really that the student is developing both of these aspects within their meditation, whatever their form of meditation is. Because the meditation itself is an upaya, is a vehicle, but the mind of the student, the mind of the meditator, is where the calming, the serenity, tranquility, the samadhi, and the insight is taking place. And that has everything to do with how the student is using their mind, developing their mind within that form of meditation. And so, but those two charges against silent illumination, which, as I mentioned the other day, when Dogen went to China and he studied with Zhu Qing, he was studying at the same monastery that Hongzhi had been the abbot of, and so he was right in the midst of that whole lineage and sort of practice tradition. When he came back to Japan, he spoke of it as shikantaza, just sitting, just awareness. And so the tendency, or the thing that students of shikantaza or silent illumination need to be careful of, is passivity on the one hand, that the mind just becomes dull because there's no object of concentration, that they just are in ongoing thought processes, daydreaming, because there is no object of concentration. And then because there is no object, how are they bringing forth insight? With koan study, the danger is always that the mind is just going to get tangled up in the language and the meaning and the phrases of the koans themselves. And so that the student will not be really developing their ground of concentration, but just sort of turning within the koan, the words of the koan, and being very conceptual and intellectual. In the Guidepost for Silent Illumination, another poem by Hongzhi, He said, Hongzhi said, if illumination neglects serenity, then aggressiveness appears. If serenity or samadhi neglects illumination or insight, murkiness leads to wasted dharma. When silent illumination is fulfilled, the lotus blossoms and the dreamer awakens. That is, that there is awakening insight within a mind and body of samadhi. Of course, the other essential element of both meditation and everything that we call practice in the Buddha Dharma is morality, the precepts, compassion. And so those three, the calming the mind, insight, and morality are the three essentials that make any form of Buddhist practice Buddhist and makes our meditation within this great wisdom tradition of the Buddha, which means we want to make sure that those three elements are present within our practice. And so when we're sitting zazen and, you know, being really negative or self-critical, or, you know, that's not developing and bringing forth compassion. And so, you know, maybe if we remember that, oh yeah, that's supposed to be part of what I'm doing, that will help us to be one way of helping us to realize this isn't, not only is it not helping me, but it's not actually practicing my meditation in accord with the teachings. And so Hongzhi, in the picking up where we left off in the poem, one beam of light's gleam permeates the vastness. The gleam permeates through all directions. From the beginning, nothing is covered, nothing is concealed. And again, I've said this before, that, you know, in the teachings, there's nothing new. You know, that the role of a teacher is not to discover, in a sense, something new about the Buddha Dharma, because that's pretty well been done. But rather to bring forth that which is the Dharma, that which has been revealed, discovered, realized, beginning with the Buddha all the way down to the present time. And typically bringing it forth within the style, if you will, of that teacher's lineage. And so this is exactly what Hongzhi is doing here. He's not saying anything that you haven't already heard, that has been already said over and over again, but we need to hear it again. And every time we hear it in a new way. It's expressed in a slightly different way. Yunmen said, within heaven and earth, throughout space and time, there is a light hidden within this mountain of form. There is a light that seems to be hidden within this mountain and form. It isn't concealed, and it isn't covered. That's what we realize. But this beam, this light's gleam that Hongzhi speaks about, is spoken of as radiance, right? As brilliance, as a shining awareness. Bodhidharma speaks of mind as miraculous awareness, Buddha, that permeates all directions, which is another way of saying there is nothing to obstruct it. And because it's likened to the sun, which shines in all directions, it illuminates everything within its path. And because this illumination has no path, its path is everywhere, it illuminates everything. And so when he says, from the beginning, this is what training helps us to discover, is that after so much seeking and struggling, and striving and inner struggle, and all of our attempts to try one last time to successfully appropriate something as ourself and have it work out, and trying one more time to extinguish that which we're trying to get away from. Ultimately, when all of that is exhausted, which is usually after we have become exhausted, and it usually goes in that order, we get exhausted, and then we're ready to let all of those machinations be exhausted. Then we see from the beginning that nothing was covered or concealed. It's not a result of practice, although without practice, it's very difficult to realize this. You know, it's like our confusion. We talk about our confusion. We can think of that as, well, however we might think about it. But confusion is having understanding. That when we are confused, we have understanding. It's just not working. It's not matching. It's not appropriate to the need because it's not based in a reality that gives us the understanding that we would need to not be confused. And so, while it's important to have faith and to believe in ourselves and our capacity and to have aspiration, and all of these are really important and very powerful and need to be cultivated and strengthened and in which we find more continuity, more constancy, they're still dukkha in the sense that they're impermanent. They're virtuous, they're good, but they're still dukkha because they are impermanent. So we can't ultimately rely upon them, though we turn towards these qualities and cultivate them throughout our practice lives. But it's our experience, and in essence, our experience of that which is not conditioned, which is not created, which is not permanent, that ultimately frees us. Catching the opportunity to emerge amid transformations, it flourishes. Following appropriately amid transformations, the pure bliss is unchanged. He speaks of it, he says it flourishes, this light that radiates in all directions, which is your mind, your nature. We call it Buddha nature. We have words and phrases and ways of speaking of this because we need those. They're convenient to use. How else? That because it is one way we can communicate and communicate from the very beginning because we understand and trust language, sometimes too much. But this nature itself is, by its nature, inexpressible. It's not that no one has ever found the right way. It's not possible. It's not of the nature of this light, this miraculous awareness, to be able to capture it in language. And yet, there are many very valiant efforts to do so. How can it be held back? Flourishing. In a sense, that's what our practice is about, is to help us to flourish within our lives. You know, it's like when you see a plant that is happy, right? You look at it, you realize this plant is happy, right? How do we know? Because it's flourishing. And so to have faith and to practice in the basis of that faith and of our and to develop a real confidence and conviction that you can realize your self nature, which is most important, that you have that faith before we have experienced it as true for ourselves. You know, it's like if you lived in a climate, in a place where you never saw the sun, you never actually saw the sun. You could have faith in it. You've read poems about it. Stories have been written. You've heard descriptions about it. You feel its warmth, or you feel warmth, and people say that's coming from the sun. You see shadows, And you're told that those shadows are created by the sun, but you haven't actually seen the sun. But you're experiencing all of these, all of the radiance of the sun. And Buddha nature is kind of like that, right? That we're experiencing all of these, all of this radiance. How else could we be here? I mean, if we were just fundamentally deluded, right? If we didn't actually possess, if we weren't actually that nature ourselves, would we really have sufficient faith given, you know, the evidence of our lives and our world that one, it existed, and two, I could realize it? My way of seeing, the only way we can actually raise bodhicitta and establish any degree of faith in the Dharma is because Buddha nature is already present. And that's its radiance sort of leaking out. Amid the transformations, it flourishes. Hongzhu said, if you see horns on a distant hill, then you know there's an ox there. If you see smoke rising above the mountain, you know there's a fire. But what is it that all of you here know for certain? What can you know for certain, given how fickle, mercurial, ideas, beliefs, emotions, everything comes and goes? What do you know for sure? What can you actually take refuge in? He says, do you know? When a bird calls from its roost, morning has come. When you smell the plum blossom, spring has arrived. Being amidst the transformations, it flourishes. The radiance is sensed even before we realize it. You know, transformation is such a funny word, or a particular word, and it kind of matches our sense of what we think is going to happen, right? That something that is going to be a new is. That this self that I am is going to become a new self. The desire to be something or someone or somewhere that is different than this one, this thing, this place. That something that is somehow flawed is going to transform into something that is now enlightened, that is new, that is safe, that is perfect. And that path, of course, along that path, there is only disappointment. In the moment, there's excitement. I mean, in the beginning, there's excitement, right? And enthusiasm, because we're getting ready to transform into our new self. Right? And we're excited about it. We can't wait. Right? We can't wait, and we do wait. And then we are disappointed. And now we are that much closer to actually practicing. Because that path is really just more of the same. It's just more of the same. It's kind of like, you know, we imagine ourselves as the caterpillar which becomes the butterfly. That's why Dogen said, if you want to attain the matter of suchness, you have to be a person of suchness. That's the way it's arranged. That's the deal. You already are a person of suchness, so don't worry. And I think this whole, you know, wrestling with this sense of transformation and all the different ways that we might relate to that within ourselves or imagine practice to be that, I think even more so because of our culture of sort of extreme individualism. You know, and so that you know, all the many paths of self-improvement. And, you know, we practice the precepts. We are very much about, you know, recognizing what is unskillful and what is unwholesome and what is creating suffering and transforming that. But what is transformation itself within Buddha Dharma? When there is no abiding self, when there is no thing, no thingness within things, no selfness within this self, then what does transformation mean? The Buddha said, because of causes and conditions, there is only experience in this moment. And so in a sense, we could say transformation is just this moment of experience, this suchness. And the causes and conditions and the consequences, those are being experienced in a different way. I mean, if we have all of our, sort of illustrious imaginings about what transformations we're going to undergo, just take a look at the dude in the 10th ox herding picture downstairs. Dusty, ragged, dumpy. Nobody you'd notice. Not a standout in the crowd, kind of. Amid the transformations, it flourishes. And following appropriately amid the transformations, this pure bliss is unchanged because it's bliss. Because it's bliss, it is unchanged. Because it is unchanging, it's bliss. That's the essence of liberation, is that it is no longer dependent. Every moment, the world appears and disappears. Transformation. And appropriately, within each of those moments, each of those births and deaths, that light perfectly illuminates. The idea of discord, right, of disharmony, is an idea. I remember the first time when I was living in the city many, many years ago, I went to a concert of, I think, the National Chinese Orchestra. I mean, it was a Chinese orchestra. I don't remember what city it was from. And I remember sitting down knowing nothing about this music, but I was a classical musician, Western trained, and I started listening. I was like, oh, my God. It just seems so discordant. And as I was listening, I thought, but it can't sound like this to them. And it really got me thinking, like, what is, because I just took for granted, harmony is this. This is what harmony sounds like. The sky encompasses it, the ocean seals it, every moment without deficiency. In the achievement without deficiency, inside and outside are interfused. It's like with the teachings, you could almost take any phrase, any line, and just spend the rest of your life studying that one phrase. This is the real nature of things, prajnaparamita. Inside and outside interfused. And again, it's just the struggle of our language to speak of it, because interfused means there are two things that have now been fused into one thing, which again matches our sense of, what we're going to do. We're going to sort of mash together relative and absolute. We're going to sort of grind together, heaven and hell. That all the dualities are somehow just going to be, melted down. And so we have to, as we're reading this, we have to, in a sense, translate it and understand that the language is inadequate by its nature. And so interfused here means already from the beginning, inside and outside, are not apart. How is this? But everything in our training. to really have that faith and to practice within the faith that every moment is without deficiency. I mean, think about that. If you really contemplate that and take that in deeply, then in every moment that we just flush down the toilet, right? Because this is not a practice moment. This is not a moment that has anything to offer me. There's nothing radiant here. It's boring, it's bullshit, it's trivial, it's in between. Every moment by its nature is without deficiency, is complete. Every mind moment by its nature is complete. So then why does this moment seem lacking? Within Sesshin, before and after Sesshin, this is so. In the achievement without deficiency, this achievement has no failure. You know, we can practice in accord with the Dharma or not. We can do something else while we're sitting on this cushion. But achievement, which is the bliss, which is continuous and unchanging, is without failure. It's hongzhers. My life is one continuous mistake. What we need to study, what we need to reflect, what we need to practice, what we need to realize is present in full. Sometimes the moment appears like an open door. You just pass through. Sometimes it's locked. There's not even a keyhole. But that's just how it appears to us. And so when we are in those moments, and I remember lots of moments in my early years, particularly here when I was really, you know, was really taking up and I think introduced in a real way that hadn't really happened when I was on my own, of the notion of practicing my life, of inside and outside interfusing and wanting that so badly, so deeply, that I would make myself miserable with my wanting and my frustration and impatience. But there were moments where there was a kind of desperation. I don't know, how do I practice this moment? And usually they were very simple moments. There was nothing complicated about them. But I was looking for some, you know, instructions. I was looking for some, I don't know, something. I was making it way too complicated. Sitting in the hall of pure bliss, silent and still. The restlessness, the discomfort, the anxiety, when it doesn't yield, guess what? You yield. I yield. And then we realize the door, the gate is gateless. All dharmas transcend their limits. All gates are wide open. Through these open gates are the byways of playful wandering. Playful wandering. Samadhi is often spoken of as the field of playfulness. It's another way of speaking about joyfulness, about spontaneity, about not being bound. All the gates are wide open. If the dharmas are boundless, how can they transcend? If everything is already uncovered and revealed, how can we transcend ourself or delusion? transcendence, and again, like transformation, like so many of these words, are just approximations. Nothing is going beyond. What we transcend, in a sense, is the very idea of transcendence. The idea of Dharma, the idea of delusion. The idea of a gate that's closed. And he's saying these truths for us to know and to remember, so that in the moment when we're encountering a gate that seems resolutely shut, impassable, untractable, intractable, impossible, that we call to mind these teachings and realize that all I'm experiencing is the limits of my ability to be limitless. Dropping off senses and sense objects is like the flowers of our gazing and listening falling away. Gazing and listening are only distant conditions of thousands of hands and eyes. Letting go of our senses, our sense objects. You know, I spoke the other day about how sort of dominant our senses are, and so how much we rely on them, we trust them, we take refuge in them, we turn to them, we measure them, we... And so to let them rest, please, let them rest. They've been working so hard. And then the objects of our senses rest. Those objects that we're, you know, building in, you know, burying in concrete to throw into the ocean, and those that we're putting up on the shrine. Also, let those objects rest for a while. Let everything rest. Dropping off the senses and sense objects is like the flowers of our gazing and listening falling away. He's referring here, I think, to a phrase that's often used as flowers of emptiness. That if you, you know, if you rub your eyes and then you look up at the sky, you see twinkles, flowers. They're not real, but you see something. And so that the illusory solidity, otherness, intractability of all that comes through our senses and our objects and our consciousness falls away, drops, is relaxed. These are only distant conditions of the thousand hands of eyes of Kanon Bodhisattva. Distant conditions. That as they fall away, now rather than gazing, we see. Now that rather than listening, we hear. With the whole body and mind. Like Dongshan said, you see with your ears, hear with your eyes. Which are the thousand hands and eyes. Which is what it all comes down to. Which is why calming and illumination is so important. And why compassion is the essential third leg of that tripod, if you will. Because wisdom itself has no legs. It doesn't have any hands and eyes. In a sense, it's cold. That's why the image of a frozen winter, I was going to say dead. It's not dead. That ash tree out in the field, right, is an image of that absolute, right? No life, no leaves, no colors, no juices flowing, and yet there are vines encircling it. Life. That's compassion. The thousand hands and eyes. Compassion, in a sense, is the warmth You know, sometimes in winter, particularly in late winter, it's still very cold, and you feel that first breeze that's cold and yet somehow has warmth in it. You know, that amazing experience? That's compassion. That's why, as Hojin Sensei talked about yesterday with emotion, you know, sensation, this body, it itself, right, is never the barrier. It's our understanding, it's the way we move and don't cease from moving within these senses and emotions. And until we cease from moving, we can't see them. We can't experience them directly because we're moving. We're distracted. And so to see what before was a disturbance in our mind and now see it without discriminating, to see it with the thousand hands and eyes. You know, it's like you can study all the many moments when you don't feel generous, right? Your generosity is constricted, or you're feeling stingy. You don't want to let it out, or you feel resistant or held back. The hands and eyes are there, but they're bound, right? Or they're cold, a little numb, or maybe they're tied behind our backs, or whatever image you want to come up with. They're not bound. They're not tied. And that's why in the very next moment, that constriction releases. That coldness becomes warm. That's what's so important about the constancy of Sesshin, is seeing heaven and hell pass by. Summer and winter interchange from one moment to the next. For us to see, nothing of this is fixed. Others die from being too busy, but I maintain continuity. In the wonder of this continuity are no traces of subtle identifications. We don't need to continue grasping at all that I am and all that I am not. Finally, you're just you. But not how we would be, you're only you in the beginning. Because in the beginning, that would just mean I just keep doing what I've always done, believing what I've always believed, seeing myself as separate from everything else. That's what being me tends to mean. I maintain continuity. Within purity is bliss, within silence is illumination. The house of silent illumination is the hall of pure bliss. This house, this hall, this house, this hall. Everywhere you go, it appears. Dwelling in peace and forgetting hardship, let go of adornments and become genuine. The motto for becoming genuine, nothing is gained by speaking. The goodness of Vimalakirti enters the gate of Dharma, of non-duality. It's referring to the chapter in the Vimalakirti Sutra where the question of what is the Dharma gate of non-duality? And after all the bodhisattvas have expounded their profound dharmas, Vimalakirti remains silent. That is his speaking. To let go of all adornments and forget hardship. You know, Da Wei, that I spoke about earlier. You know, we can think back, sometimes I think back about, you know, these glorious, you know, eras of these great masters, and, you know, they were living within Buddhist countries and everything was just, you know, wonderful. He twice was run out of town with all of his sangha, his monks, because of social disruption and persecution. And the second time, half of his sangha, he had 100 monks, half of them died to plague and to famine. Think about that. We're here and we're starving to death, dying of plague and famine. So when Hongzhu speaks of forgetting hardship, he's not speaking from the top of a lofty hill. He's in it. He knows it. So now what is forgetting hardship? That's why atonement is so important. Because we can't just forget. We can't just put it away. If we're going to... Forgetting has to be true forgetting. It has to be true release, true letting go. And so that's why atonement is so important, to take responsibility. That's why forgiving is so important. I was saying to somebody earlier, forgiving is to give up our right to be resented, to have resentment, right? Which you have the right to resent for the rest of your life, right? Nobody can take that right away from you. To forgive means I give that up. I don't have to. But I practice, I choose giving that up. The motto for becoming genuine, nothing is gained by speaking. Nothing is gained by telling myself the story of my hardships, of my situation, of my challenges, of my insufficiencies. Nothing is gained by ignoring my hardships, my situations, my imperfections. To be genuine in being and non-being. To be genuine in this moment. Which is kind of like, you know, serenity. How do you be serene? You know, what? Look like serenity? We find serenity when we let go of our hatred, our ill will. We experience authenticity, being genuine, in the moments when we recognize and let go of not being genuine, of contrivance. Nothing is gained by speaking. And yet in speaking, when we speak rightly, it helps us to come closer. So I wanted to actually jump over, and not so much, and let Shi Dao and the faith mind end the poem. One thing, all things, move among them and intermingle without distinction within non-duality. To live in this realization is to have no anxiety about non-perfection. Hongzhi's one continuous mistake. Shi Dao's, the Buddha's, yours, mine. We are part of a long lineage of dignified imperfections, noble imperfections, continuous imperfections. If you want to be part of the human tribe, they come with you. To live in this realization is to be free, finally, to be not anxious about imperfections. To live in this faith is the road to non-duality, because the non-dual is the one with the trusting mind. And so when you practice that trust, that faith, you're practicing being intimate, unified with non-duality, with serenity, with constancy, with bliss, with selflessness. It may not be in our cognitive mind yet. We may not realize it yet, but that's why we can relax. It's why we can let go. It's why one moment of storm becomes the next moment's calm. And so let's just practice. That's all. It's not complicated. It's not always easy. But it's not complicated. When it becomes complicated, just start again. That's all.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.